Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Today we're going to be in 1 Samuel chapter 8. It's a very pivotal chapter in understanding the book of Samuel. In chapters 1 through 7, we deal with Samuel as the ideal judge or prophet leading the people in Yahweh's name. But as we come to chapter 8, is that major pivotal chapter on the change from charismatic, God-called tribal leaders like the judges, of which Samuel is a part, to the monarchy that's going to be the basis of the divinic promises of the Messiah in 2 Samuel chapter 7. Now, there was some tension here. This was not an easy transition for them. They were used to the nomadic, tribal, charismatic leader. And now they were coming to a settled monarchy. Now, there are two sets of books that are going to help that I want to show you in a passage like 1 Samuel. A lot of times there's not real good commentaries available on these historical books. The first ones I want to show you is a two-volume set, volumes 1 and 2. One is Religious Institutions and one is Social Institutions. It's by Roland DeVoe, a French scholar, and this is called Ancient Israel, volumes 1 and 2. Now, the reason I like these so much is because they are extensively indexed, just page after page after page. Now, let me just give you a little clue. If you buy these books and put them on shelf 29 of your library, you'll never reach them. And books are only good reference books if you use them. So if you'll get a red pen or a blue pen or a green pen, and for every book in your reference library, make a mark on your book. And then put that mark in the margin of your study Bible by the verses which are mentioned in here. And that way, whenever you're studying a passage, you'll know the reference book to go to look up in the index. Now, none of us have a memory that can hold all this stuff. And so an index or filing system is crucial. These books are only helpful. They're not to sit down and read. You'll never get through it. But they are to deal with passages in context with other things that are happening in Israel. Another book I want to show you is a real good one called Bible Difficulties. It's by a man named Archer. Now, this book is going to deal with the problems in the text. Now, it deals with 1 Samuel 8 because of the discrepancy between some wanting the monarchy and some against the monarchy. Now, basically, this tension over the monarchy, I think, can be explained not in the fact that Samuel was mad because they asked for a king, but he was mad because of why they asked for a king. Now, I want to show you the ambiguity in this text. We have a crawl we want to do for you to show you those who are for the monarchy, and that's going to be several, and those who are against. And so you can look at those different scripture texts and see those different references in Samuel. Some take it even further and make allusions in the prophets, but I think that's going too far. Now, notice, if you would, please, where it says, "And it came about when Samuel was old that he appointed his sons judges over Israel." Now, Samuel was a Nazarite, an Ephraimic labor leader, just like Jeroboam the first is going to be in later history. His name means his name, El. And we think his mother gave him that because he was called by God. It was a special birth. You might want to see Samuel 1:20. Now, he appointed his sons over Israel. The problem here is that judgeship was never given by inheritance from father to son. It was always God's special call of a man. And now here we have a man whose sons are not going to measure up to the standards. Now, isn't it funny? Eli's sons did not follow in his ways, and God called Samuel. Samuel's sons did not follow in his ways, and the people wanted a king, Saul. Saul's son Jonathan was a wonderful boy, though the daddy wasn't. And then we have David. But look what happened to David's children. Then we have Solomon. Look what happened to Solomon's children. One of the problems of a monarchy was this deal of succession. Many times a man's children were not fit for this high religious as well as political office for the nation of Israel. And so succession had proven to be a problem in the judges, and it's going to be a problem in the monarchy also. Now, here's his two sons. The name of his firstborn was Joel, which means Yahweh is God. The name of his second son was Abijah, which means Yahweh is father. And they were judging Israel in Beersheba. Now, the very fact that he named these boys after religious names shows something of what that daddy wanted. You know, all of us as parents, we want our children to be godly children. We want them to love the Lord and walk in his ways. how often our desires prove not to be true. And that was the example here. Now, it said they were judging in Beersheba. Now, Josephus tells us that one boy was judging in Beersheba and one boy was judging in Bethel. And we're going to go to a map shot and show you where Bethel and Beersheba is. Notice that Beersheba is in southern Judea, almost the farthest point. That's what Beer means, the well of Sheba. And that Bethel is about 12 miles north of Jerusalem. It was the cultic center later for the northern 10 tribes. Okay. Now, however, the fact that he was in Beersheba shows that Israel had taken back some land from the Philistines. Now, we see that the reason that the people wanted a king is because the Philistine pressure was something they could not handle. It was a continuous, powerful, exertive pressure on their western border, and Israel could not handle it by local armies or tribes. Now, in chapter 7, verses 12 through 17 is a summary of Samuel's ministry. Samuel was a godly man, but he was not a military leader. He could not lead the people against the Philistines. Now, he had a word from God, but he did not seem to be a military leader. And so the people are going to want a military-type, charismatic king. His son, Sarah, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside. Now, from Exodus 23, verse 2, we realize they were using their office for personal gain. There's nothing new in politics, is there? And took bribes and perverted justice. Okay? And then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. Now, these elders would be tribal leaders. And back in Moses' time, we see them. Back even in Egypt, we see them. Now, Ramah is Samuel's hometown. Chapter 7, verse 17. We realize that. Maybe he was too old to make the circuit anymore, and he was at his hometown, and people had to come to him. We're just not sure. And they said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations." Now, the problem was not that they asked for a king. And I want to try to show that to you. If you'll turn back in your Old Testament to the call of Abraham in Genesis 17:6, God says to Abraham, "Kings will come out of you." There is a special reference to the kingship in the prophecy toward Judah in Genesis 49:10. And there is a specific reference to the fact that Israel will have a king by Moses in his closing address to the people in Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 through 20. So it was not unusual or uncalled for. They seemed to even be in quote Deuteronomy 17, reminding Samuel that it was God's pre-stated will that at some point Israel have a king. But the real kicker is not that, even though I think Samuel was somewhat affronted, because really he was the king in every way but official title. He had that kind of authority, that kind of influence, that kind of power. And I think he felt a little put down by this, even though he realized his sons were really not spiritually capable of following his footsteps. And he felt offended and hurt. And his feelings were somewhat displaced in this. But what really bothered him is this little phrase where it says, "like all the nations." Now, see, it wasn't the request was the problem. It was their attitude that was the problem. The same thing is referenced to in verse 20, that we may be like all the nations. You see, that was the exact purpose of Israel, that she be totally different from the nations. That's the purpose of her food law. That's the purpose of her sacrificial system. That's the purpose of every aspect of her life, was that she be different. And here she wanted to be just like them. Now, we must remember that she is not just like the nations politically that she's in closest contact to. This is not the way the Canaanites did it. They did not have a king. They had city-states. This is not the way the Philistines did it. They had five different lords of the Philistines. It was a group or a council of leadership. But this is very similar to what we know from Ugaritic text as the Syrian form of government, and we see the same form in Egypt. And so really what Israel's asking for is a oriental monarchy like Syria or Egypt. Okay? Now, but the thing was displeasing to the sight of Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. Now, I think it's a real important thing. Number one, they thought they could solve their problem by changing governmental forms. They thought if they just had a different structure of political systems, that they wouldn't have any problem for the Philistines. Friends, we've been caught in that trap a long time as humanity, thinking if we just change governments, if we just change systems, if we just change political leaders, then we're going to be able to overcome our problems. Never happened. Never happened. I think it's a real smart man, Samuel, though he was filled with the Lord and sought him. Samuel didn't make a rash, quick decision. He said, guys, I need some time to pray about this. Now, he was ticked off, and it showed. They recognized it. But he just didn't answer out of his anger. He said, I need to go pray about this. And when I get a word from the Lord, then I'll come back and talk to you. So Samuel is not going to give his message. He's going to go seek the Lord. Verse 7. And the Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Now you see, the difference of Israel was that she did have a king, and it was Yahweh, the covenant God. And he was in their midst. That's what the tabernacle was for. It showed that God lived with his people. And he was to give them the information they needed through the priest and through the Urim and the Thummim and all those other ways that God had chosen to lead his people. But oh, they would not. They would not. Over and over again, God tried to do it that way, and they would not. God was meant to be the king, and even later in Israel, the king was simply a representative of God. That's why the king's sins were such an abomination. Now, one thing I want to say to those of you who teach Sunday school, preach, give devotionals, share your testimony. Friends, we're going to be in places where people reject our message. But we've got to remember that we can never take that personally. Because when we speak what we believe the Lord's put on our heart, we do the best we can to speak for Him. If people turn away, they're not rejecting us. They're rejecting Him in whose name we speak. And we must remember that. We must remember that. Now, like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up from the land of Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now, in 2 Kings 21:15, this same thing is said. The people of Israel had a settled tendency toward unfaithfulness toward God. They'd make promises they would not keep. From their very beginnings, they had been rebellious and stiff-necked, and I personally believe that's just why God chose them. Just why God chose them. Because you see, if God can love a people so rebellious, so stiff-necked, He can love anybody. Now, it continues then in verse 9. Now then, listen to their voice. However, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them. Now, the ideal king is mentioned in Deuteronomy 17, 14 through 20. But the practical outlay or the practical procedures or the norm for Oriental monarchs is going to be shown to them. Their lives won't be their own anymore. The taxation will be doubled. They'll be drafted for work. The military machine will have to be fed. He's saying this way it's going to be, guys. I want you to know up front the cost of having a king. And here it is. Verses 10 through 17 are that cost. Now, in verse 11, we're talking about the pomp and the majesty and the circumstance of Oriental palaces. Notice what it says. Verse 10, it says, and Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked him for a king. By the way, there's a play on the word who asked for. The word Saul is in that Hebrew phrase. That's neat, isn't it? In verse 11, it says, and this will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and place them for himself in his. Now, every translation I looked at had the word chariots, plural. But the Masoretic text has chariot, singular. Now, this is not the army yet. This is the royal chariot, okay? And then it says, among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariot, singular. Now, we learn this is the grand procession, footmen, horsemen, coming before the royal chariot of the king. And so it's pomp and circumstance, if you please, in verse 11. And then in verse 12 is the military. He's going to draft commanders of thousands and fifties, and then he's going to take some to do plowing and reaping and harvest and to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. king, there's going to be a military price to pay. Now, in verses 13 through 17 is the support of the monarchy as far as social standing. First, we have the staff, the men and women that will be required to run this monarchy. And second is the requirements of foodstuffs to feed all this grand array of leaders, if you please. And so that's what's going to happen. Notice the word in 14, and give them to your servants. Now, we learned from these Ugaritic texts that we found, it's been 20, 30 years ago now, maybe more. They show us that these gifts, the word servants, it means a high official. And this is like giving land grants to his high officials, is what it's talking about. Now, he's going to take that land from somebody to do that. Notice where it says, and I will take, he will take a tenth of your seed. Now, this idea of a tithe, we've also found in Ugaritic texts that's very much like this Syrian monarchy I was telling you about. This is a taxation exactly the same as the religious taxation. So what we're doing is doubling the taxes on the people. Now, then it says, notice it says, and give his officers and to his servants. Now, his officers is an Akkadian word. It usually is translated eunuchs. In Akkadian, it means the head one or the one at the head. Now, some were castrated, like the maybe even Daniel and his three friends were. We're not sure. But many times these Oriental monarchs would physically alter these young men so that they could keep the harem or keep their mind on business or whatever. And so, but remember Potiphar in Joseph's life? He was married, and he's called a eunuch, so everybody wasn't castrated who's called a eunuch. Then it says, and he will take your male servants, your female servants, and your best young men and your donkeys and use them for his work. Now, your best young men, the Septuagint, change one Hebrew consonant. And by changing one Hebrew consonant, you get the word oxen. I think the Septuagint translated best herds. Now, I'm surprised he would put best young men between his female servants and his donkeys. So I really think probably the Septuagint is a better text than the Masoretic text here. Notice in verse 18, then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourself, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. Now you will cry out. If you have ever read the book of Judges, that is a common word in the book of Judges. And they were oppressed by the Moabites, and they cried out to God. And they were oppressed by the Amalekites, and they cried out to God. And they were oppressed by the on and on, and they cried out to God. Well, here they're going to cry out to God, but not because of a foreign enemy, but because of their own king. And God says, I will not hear you in that day. You've made your bed. Now you're going to have to lay in it. I want you to know that their request is going to turn into a tragedy. Here's a good example of one of the worst things God could do for us is answer all our prayers. I want to tell you, most of us don't know what we need. We know what we want, but not what we need. God's going to give them what they ask for. It's the worst thing possibly happened to them. Now, when it says, you have chosen for yourself, in Deuteronomy 17, 14 and 15, it says, a king that I will choose for you. Now, I don't think this is a contradiction. One is looking at it from a theological point of view. They asked Samuel to do it. The other is looking from just a social descriptive point of view. The people ask for a king. Now, I don't think that's a contradiction. It's just looking at the same event from two different ways. Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel and said, no, but there shall be a king over us. This is kind of the deal. Don't give us facts. We made up our mind. That's what they're doing. They're saying, we've already decided. Don't try to tell us this or that. Now, friends, this is a good example of the dichotomy in the Bible, the paradox, if you please, between God's sovereignty that's seen so clearly in the first part of Samuel and man's free will that is also seen so clearly right here. God can do what God wants to do, but God tells Samuel three times in this chapter, do what they say, Samuel. They've decided, let them decide. They'll suffer the consequence of their act, but let them decide. You see, there's a real tension between God is sovereign and man is free. And the Bible lives in that tension. Notice, if you would, in verse 20 where it says then, that they also may be like all the nations. And there's the real problem. They were not to be like all the nations in anything. That our king may judge us. Now, see, that's what Samuel was doing so effectively. They didn't really want to judge. They didn't really want to hear the words of God. They just wanted to have a symbol to tell them. And then finally it says to go out before us and fight our battles. Aha! Now here's the real what they want. They want a king that will go out and beat the Philistines. Now, we can already see the amalgamation effect of the foreign nations permeating the people of Israel. It's going to be so clear in the later monarchy, where Baal worship is going to come in, and all of the Canaanite fertility practices, the astral deities of Babylon and the star gods of Assyria. Israel is going to keep God's name, but she's going to take the worship of all the deities around. We even found that some of the Egyptian deities made an inroad. Did you know that in Amos's book, where it says they have palaces of ivory, we have found archaeologically the ivory inlays from this period, and they have Egyptian gods carved on them. It was in God's name, but it was not Yahweh's religion. Now, notice if you would in verse 21. Now, after Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the Lord's hearing. Now, isn't that a funny phrase? I read that, and I underlined it and put a star by it, and I said, what an unusual thing. Did Samuel think that God didn't hear him when the people told him? Did Samuel think that he was the only mediator between God and man, and he had to tell God what the people said? Doesn't that show a little idiosyncrasy on Samuel's part? Samuel's had his feelings hurt because they say, now, we want a king to judge us. And Samuel kind of thinks, they're rejecting me. So here's Samuel, a little psychological, I admit. I think Samuel's saying, now, Lord, I'm going to tell you what they said to me. Samuel kind of feels like he's back in the flow again, if you please. Isn't that an unusual phrase? And he repeated to them in the Lord's hearing. Now, this may have been his quiet time, his prayer time. He may have gone into one of the altars, whether at Ramoth, where he built an altar to the Lord, or one of the cultic sites like Bethel. We don't know. But here he's in an intimate time of talking to the Lord and saying, Lord, did you hear what they said? Lord, did you hear what they said? Do you ever have times like that where you know God knows the past, the future, the present, but you just get off by yourself in a time of prayer and tell the Lord what folks have done to you? Well, He knows what folks have done to you, but isn't it good to know we can go to Him and say, God, did you hear what they said? Did you hear? Let me tell you what they said. And that's what we have right here. The Lord said to Samuel, listen to their voice and appoint them a king. So Samuel said to the men of Israel, go every man to his own city. He's going to do it for them. Notice what God said. Listen to them. Appoint them a king. They've chosen. They will bear the consequences of their choice. Now, here we have a perfect example. I think this is almost congregational polity that we see in the New Testament. The people are going to choose. Okay. They've rejected God's best counsel. Okay. Now they're going to bear the consequences of their act. But Samuel says, guys, go home for a while. I'm not going to make a snap decision. I'm not going to pick one of you either. I think these elders thought one of them would be king, and they were just waiting to see which one Samuel would pick. And Samuel says, go home, men. We don't know how many days or weeks or months pass in the interim before Saul, son of Kish, is going to be here. But we're going to find him in chapters 9 through 11. He's going to take a while to make his choice. I read something I thought was probably true. It said that God chose Saul to show Israel what a bad king is like. He had a terrible temper problem. He had all kinds of personality problems. Maybe God is setting the stage through Saul for them to really appreciate David. You think? It may be so. Well, I hope you'll take advantage of looking at these books. I want to tell you, this little book is so neat. I'm going to go back over these books again just so you'll have them. Bible difficulties will deal with Old Testament and New. Every difficult passage or phrase, this will cover. Now, this is not as good as F.F. Bruce's book called Questions and Answers, but F.F. Bruce's book is out of print. If you find it, man, buy it. If you can even borrow one, mimeograph it. That's a great book, F.F. Bruce, Questions and Answers. This is the same kind of book in a little different scale. But now, this other book, these are really cheapies. I bought them for $2.95 a piece. I don't know how long ago I bought them, but I bet they're a lot more than that now. Institutions of Israel, Religious and Social. This will open your eyes to cultural things you've never, ever seen. This is a way of getting back to biblical authority. We must see what the biblical author was saying to the people of his day before we can apply the truth to our day. Now, we're thousands of years away from David and from Saul and Samuel. And sometimes we don't always understand why they do this or that. And so these books will help you get back and walk the streets of Ramah. Get you back and help walk the streets of Jerusalem. These books will help you get your mindset back into an ancient culture. And when you fully understand what they were saying to the people of their day, then you can get the universal truth and you can apply it to our truth. You know, most of the Bible study I hear in modern America is treating the Bible as if it were the morning newspaper. Now, you can't treat the Bible like the morning newspaper. It is an ancient book that must be interpreted in its context. And these kind of reference books will really help you do that. And I think it'll be a blessing to your life if you use them. Now, don't buy them and put them on your shelf and say, boy, what a great library I have. Index them. Take that extra couple of hours to index them in your study Bible, and they'll really be of help when you come to passages like this. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.